Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Southern comedian Jeff Foxworthy has made Americans laugh for decades with his redneck-style humor. It might surprise you that Jeff is also a cookbook author and recently hosted the Great American Baking Competition. Jeff's here with plenty of food talk served up with a big helping of laughs. We're also joined by Drew Ramsey of Hubig's Pies with news about when we can eat those delicious little pies of his again and reveals exactly where they'll be made. Then, Chef Jared Zarang tells the story of his agrarian upbringing just upriver in Vacherie. There's no doubt we're traveling south on this week's Louisiana Eats. Jeff Foxworthy is the largest-selling comedy recording artist in history, a Grammy Award-winning winner, and best-selling author of more than 26 books. Most recently, Jeff hosted the Great American Baking Competition on CBS, and I am some kind of tickled to have him with me today. Jeff, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Oh, it's about time I was on your show.
Well, you know, I have to confess, I apologize, because aside from all of the accolades of yours that I just mentioned, I kind of overlooked the fact that you've written two cookbooks, the Jeff Foxworthy Down Home Cookbook, and then most recently, the Redneck Grill Cookbook, which you describe as the most fun you can have with fire, charcoal, and a dead animal.
Well,
so, like, what's up with that, Jeff?
Got to be a reason to crank up the grill, right? It's and of course, my wife is from Louisiana. She's a New Orleans girl. So I kind of got the idea for the outdoor cookbook watching her relatives fry the turkeys at Thanksgiving. And you can't really watch that without dialing 9-1 on your phone and just having it sitting there. That is a trip to the emergency room waiting to happen.
Just waiting to happen. You're right about that. But is there anything better than a deep-fried turkey?
No. And God bless Southerners, you know, because they had advertised turkey was the perfect healthy meat, and we found a way to fry it. God bless us.
Well, you know, I would like you to share with us some of your redneck-style grilling tips.
Well, have the garden hose nearby. I love to grill. In fact, I was grilling last night. I actually had andouille sausage and kielbasa out there and grilled that. My wife made hash brown casserole. That was a pretty good little combination.
Well, you are just such a good Southern boy, and you always have been. I really want to know, though, so what do you think separates redneck-style grilling from what everybody else is doing?
Well, the possibility exists that somebody stopped their truck on the side of the road and picked it up on the way home instead of getting it at the market like normal folks do.
That delicious roadkill element. Is it fresh? How fresh is it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, it's still warm. Throw it in the truck. Here we go.
Well, you know, Jeff, I've always believed that one of the things that really has set you apart is that you always work clean. And when I started watching your new show, The Great American Baking Competition, that was one of the first things that struck me. Nobody gets yelled at, humiliated, insulted, and none of that other nasty stuff that we usually see on these cooking competitions.
You know, somebody, in fact, sent me a thing, I guess, on Jimmy Fallon last week. I guess I'm on CBS at the same time, Gordon Ramsay. In Hell's Kitchen, and he goes, look at these differences in style, and Gordon's just screaming at people and spit coming out of his mouth and cussing people out, and I'm going, oh, man, that's delicious. Oh, let me have another bite of that. But I wanted it to be that way, and especially with baking. And I kind of stumbled onto this show. CBS called me and said, would you be interested in hosting a baking competition? And I said, no, I don't. I really don't bake. I don't know anything about it. And they said, well, it's been like the number one show in England for the last 3 years. If we send you an episode, will you watch it? And I said, sure. And my wife and I sat down to watch this thing. And 30 minutes into it, she looked at me and said, you have to do this. You're just kind of mesmerized. And you find that bakers are kind. By nature, they're givers, because this thing that they do, that they love to do, they do it to give away. They don't keep it for themselves. They bake all this stuff and then give it to their families and their neighbors and their friends. And so, you know, I thought, yeah, that's kind of right up my alley. That's the kind of show that I want to do. And it, I mean, it's still a competition and there's still anxiety within it, but they did a survey with the people that were on the show and said, what was your favorite part about this? And they said, working with Jeff, it's just a nice place to work. And I said, oh, good.
Well, you know, that's one of the cool things, too, on the CBS website, is that you can go there and there are a lot of the recipes that people are seeing on television where you can figure out how to make it right there from the website.
Yeah, and it's kind of one of those things during the course of the show. Baking's different than cooking in that, and you probably cook this way because this is the way my wife kind of cooks and tastes as she goes along, and you can adjust, you know, when you're cooking. When you're baking, not so much. I mean, when you get it all together and put it in the oven, you can't go back and go, oh, it needs more salt or it needs more, you know, lemon zest. It's a different kind of animal.
And there's a lot of chemistry involved.
A lot,
I mean, it's
of chemistry.
Really tricky. I watched the croissant episode, and I made croissants one time, and I knew that the poor woman who had put the croissant dough in the freezer was screwed.
But yeah, we all kind of did, and you can't say anything, you know, and you're like, oh, no, 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 not the freezer.
What stands out in your mind as having been particularly delicious?
Oh, my goodness. There's been so many. The ones that people come up to me in the grocery store and talk about is Francine's chocolate peanut butter and bacon pie.
Yeah.
Because when they had to submit that to the judges, Paul was like, oh, my God, that's the most disgusting thing I've ever heard of. And I'm looking at Francine thinking, I bet this girl knows what she's doing in the kitchen. I mean, you can just tell. When she finally made it and he ate it, he was like, I hate to admit this. This is one of the most delicious things I've ever had. And so that's what's fun about her, is she will give you flavor combinations, whether it's grinding up Red Hots or putting Cheerwine in something. And, you know, you're going, boy, never seen that before, but they're good. I mean, she knows what she's doing.
She really does. Okay, so we talked about particularly good. Was there anything that you had to taste that you really had the urge to spit out?
Well, here's the great thing for me. I'm not a judge, and so but I kind of stand right there next to them. So if they're really bragging about something, I had the crew guys make me a fork that is extendable, because they would never cut me in on the deal. So the fork goes out to about 3 feet long, and I can stab it and get me something to eat. But if they're talking about how bad something is, I don't have to taste it like they do.
Oh, well, that's good. And I guess you could probably take that fork and utilize it later on some redneck grilling expeditions.
Exactly. Well, in my family, you get a little bit nervous to stick your hand in there for the last piece of chicken. So, yeah, this one kind of protects the back of your hand from somebody sticking a fork in it. You just got the extendable fork.
So, Jeff, I was fascinated by the set because the whole competition was held in a giant tent.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a challenge in and of itself?
Oh, yeah, because they wanted to emulate the way they do it in England, and that's the way they do it. They set this giant tent up on the grounds of a castle. And so we set it up at a beautiful place called Gibbs Gardens, about an hour north of Atlanta. And we started shooting in the month of March, which, as you know, from Louisiana, usually that's kind of when the weather starts turning and being nice. It was so cold and so rainy. And Paul was saying, he said, here's the tricky part, is you have like three or four contestants were from California. He said, all of a sudden you get them in the South, and you're dealing with humidity, which affects all of these doughs rising. These people never had to do this. Usually when you're baking at home, you know your oven, you know your kitchen, and all of a sudden you've got an oven that doesn't heat up quite the same way. And then there were days where it was really, really cold. I don't know if it was like that in Louisiana in March, but I mean, we had just some really unusually cold weather. There was, at one point, I was watching to see who finished baking last because as soon as they yelled cut, I ran over there and put my hands in their oven. I mean, I was freezing in there. But like you said, all of those little things, because it's baking such a delicate thing, affected people's recipes.
Yeah,
you know, your heart goes out to them, but everybody's, it's an even playing field.
It's a competition with really big odds. Well, we've both raised kids, and I know that your youngest daughter, Jewel, is heading off to college soon.
Yeah.
And Jordan graduated, right?
Yeah, Jordan just graduated in 3 years, which was not quite the plan her father was on. So
does that mean that you and your wife, Greg, aren't going to really suffer from the empty nest syndrome?
Well, the last one's going off to college, but now the first one's kind of moved back in, so... You know, you're looking at each other going, wait, I thought we were about to, you know, it's been 20-something years since I've been able to walk through the house in my underwear. So, you know, what's another year or two at this point?
I just want to say thank you again so much for making this time to talk with me on Louisiana Eats. And let's not wait a really long time to do it again.
In fact, I should come do this in person so we can at least go out to eat if you can't make me something. So I really need a Louisiana fix. I haven't been there in a while.
Well, don't you dare come down here and not call me. You hear me?
You got it.
Thank you, Jeff.
I promise.
Jeff Foxworthy. And the Great American Baking Competition. The table was never completely set at my grandparents' house until the bottle of pepper vinegar had been placed there. In those days, tiny peppers of red, yellow, purple, and orange brought brilliant color to every late summer New Orleans garden. Often called bird peppers, as our feathered friends love them too, these peppers are most commonly used in making pepper vinegar. Fill a pint bottle half full with any kind of fresh, hot peppers. Then, fill the bottle full with your favorite vinegar. Cider vinegar was the usual choice of my grandfather. Screw the top on tightly and store it away in your pantry for a minimum of 1 week. The older the pepper vinegar, the better it tastes. And magically, as you use it, you can top it off with more vinegar without adding additional peppers. Just a drop or two on salads, in soups, or on your Monday red beans and rice will add a deliciously sharp accent. Get a jump on your homemade holiday gifts. Pepper vinegar made in August will be a spicy present by December. For a copy of this recipe, visit our website, wwno.org. If you have a culinary query, email us, louisianaeats@wwno.org, and we'll answer your question on a future show. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. When we come back, Drew Ramsey finally reveals when we'll be able to eat Hubig's pies again and where they'll be made. You don't want to miss this. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero's farming roots tie him to 300 years of tradition. Yet today, he's the last member of his family to make a living working the land. His ancestors once grew prized Perique tobacco in the fertile soil along the banks of the Mississippi River. But today, Our hero grows incredible numbers of rare heirloom varieties from Louisiana and all over the world. Each week at farmers markets, our hero has one of the most dazzling displays of tomatoes, eggplant, and a personal passion of his, peppers.
I have some from Portugal. I have some Scotch bonnets from Jamaica. Fatality pepper from the Central African Republic. Really, it's pretty much endless. A lot of them come from South America. The hottest pepper I grow is Butte Holokia from Northern India. It's the hottest pepper in the world. They're real hard. The seeds are a few dollars a seed. The oldest peppers are probably related to some of the white habaneros. They originate from around Brazil and Peru. Oh, yeah, and the real hot peppers are actually cool you down when it's so hot the way it is right now.
His assortment of vegetables, often never seen before in Louisiana, tempts market shoppers and provides inspiration for professional chefs.
I know Dante's Kitchen does a lot of my peppers. They have some oak barrels on the bar with little spigots and half shot glasses. Plus, they have a habanero pepper jelly that they serve with an alligator slider. And I know Josh Smith from Amano, he gets a lot of the cherry peppers. I think they're pickling them and using them on the side of some of their dishes.
That's why this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchens, is farmer Tony Accardo. Congratulations, Tony. I can't wait to see what you're bringing to market next. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Tony Accardo's heirloom produce makes some great Louisiana Eats. July 27th of 2012, Louisiana lost a culinary gem when the Hubig's Pie Factory burned to the ground in an early morning fire. A New Orleans business since 1922, the fire was an even more devastating blow to the Ramsey and Bowman families than the problems created by Hurricane Katrina. But after the fire, Hubig's Pie lovers everywhere banded together to help the Ramseys and Bowmans over this latest tragedy. Now, Hubig's Pie, third-generation pie guy, Drew Ramsey, is here with good news for pie lovers everywhere. Drew, so good to see you again.
Well, thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
The last time we visited on Louisiana Eats was very shortly after the fire. It's been a long year, huh?
It has been a long year. It has been a long and circuitous path to get here.
Well, tell me a little bit about how the community came together to support you all in the business.
Well, it's truly unbelievable, and it was the silver lining in all of this is the thoughts, the prayers, the well wishes, the notes, the pats on the back, the hugs. Obviously, people had a very high opinion of Hubig's Pies, and that means a lot. Tragedy of this level, catastrophe, would be devastating, I think, to any employer, any business, any family business in particular, and it was so for us. But when people showed up at the scene of the fire, afterwards, people bought T-shirts. The Po' Boy Festival let us set up a little booth. People came up to get a T-shirt, take a picture, tell us about how much they enjoyed the pies and that they had them at their wedding party. Or people sent them to their child who was serving overseas because that's all they wanted or something like that. Just the sheer amount of outpouring of support was truly touching.
Well, you already had a website that was up and running with merchandise on it, and obviously people all over the country didn't realize that if they went online on your website and bought pies, they weren't going to be getting any pies.
The morning of the fire was a Friday, and you know they summoned us. We went down there crack of dawn in time to see the building fully engulfed and collapse, and what was on the forefront of our mind was not let's get to the website and, you know,
right,
update the merchandise, the items on the website. You know, we had 38 employees. They were all safe. There were some people in the building when it caught on fire. Nobody was hurt. Everybody got out. The fire department did a really good job. I mean, we had a complete 100% total loss, but we were in the historic Marigny. We were not just next door, but immediately next to our neighbors. And we had a fairly large piece of property that kind of took up the middle of a block. I think we have over a dozen neighbors. Nobody lost their homes. Nobody was injured. Nobody was hurt. So that was the top priority. You know, we needed to recuperate. We needed to figure out what options were available to us. We needed to make sure our employees landed on their feet. Getting to the website was not the top priority. And by the time we did, there was thousands of orders for pies. And there was just an unbelievable amount of pie orders. And
yeah,
we had to contact each one of those people and say, we're sorry, you know, it's not possible right now. And
but the response you got from those people was kind of sweet in and of itself.
It was very sweet in and of itself. It was, keep the money. You need it more than I do right now. It was, don't worry about it. Send it to me when you can. It was whatever's easier for you, even when there was a price discrepancy, not in their favor. Just people were unbelievably generous and unbelievably understanding.
And then you created an employee fund,
and that's
where the money went.
We try to get everybody a refund. We try to swap out merchandise for people. There was a lot of vendors in the city that wanted to put a Hubig's Pie t-shirt on their shelf or do something for the cause. I'm actually reluctant to start to list all the ones that have done that.
Of course.
I know I'm going to forget somebody. But
yeah,
the Dirty Coast t-shirt shop.
Flirty Girl.
You got to love Flirty Girl.
Got to love her.
Belladonna had a day at the spa and they gave a percentage. Again, an unbelievable amount of outpouring of support. And we did. We started a little fund called Friends of Hubig's. And the money raised through those efforts was put into a fund. And we were able to get some money to the employees.
Yeah, yeah. Give them a little coverage and a little backup. And then, of course, for the last year, the Hubig's Pie Company has basically become a sort of ad hoc, by accident, merchandise retail business.
Well, there is definitely some of that. And as far as sales and money coming in, that is really all that we do. You can sell a t-shirt, a belt.
You can buy a lovely tie.
Buy a tie.
Yeah.
That was what we had left. I would really be reluctant to say that's what we were reduced to. We are...
Okay.
we are temporarily out of business pie company. We spend a lot of our time looking for used equipment, maintaining contact with our suppliers, our employers, our customers. By customers in that sense, I mean the shop owners, the people that we do direct store delivery to. And whenever possible, our ultimate customer, you know, the people who's going to buy the pie and enjoy it. We have traveled to different auctions around the country to look at equipment we might find useful. Lord, we've looked at dozens of pieces of property.
So now, finally, you're able to report some good news. What is the current status of the Hubig's Pie rebuild?
Well, we are of New Orleans, and we are always of the mindset that we wanted to stay in New Orleans. We could statutorily rebuild in the 2400 block of Dauphine Street, which we own, but that's not the most realistic alternative. It's a no-truck route. It's a residential neighborhood. We have settled on a piece of property just down the road, still in the Marigny. NOCA would sell us that piece of property. It's between Burgundy and Rampart on Press Street, or
yes,
Cotton Press Street, if you're a historian. It's directly across the street from the railway, and it is located almost smack dab in the middle of what I'm going to call the NOCA corridor, which is between NOCA on Charter Street and St. Claude Avenue. We are specking out a piece of land that is bigger than what we need, but we will be able to have some off-street parking, so there'll be no pressure on the neighborhood. And the amount of property that's left in that plot of land is almost perfect for another parking lot. And as NOCA develops, they're going to need more parking. So
mm-hmm.
It's going to be a very symbiotic relationship. We are going to build a pie factory. We don't really care what a pie factory looks like.
Yeah.
We need to make good pies on the inside of it. So we have given NOCA the authority on the outside design of the building. And what's really cool, I think, is we're thinking about making it just plain, just absolutely plain, which your listeners might think, you know, my goodness, that's not special at all. Looks like a
blank wall.
An apartment blank wall in Moscow or something. But the idea is to let NOCA students, NOCA faculty, graduated NOCA artists hang their art or do a mural on it. And one design is such that there's actually tabs on it that the art can be rotated out. And we're happy to do that. I mean, you know, we don't need to be – people aren't going to come to look at the outside of Hubig's because it's a pie factory. And if the kids can showcase their art, we're happy.
And then they will come to look at the outside
of Hubig's.
And then
they will come,
yeah. You can pretty much guarantee that. Yeah. What about all the old specialized equipment that you lost in the fire? Are you having that rebuilt?
We have recovered as much of that as we can. We have it at different warehouses around town. We do have people working on it. Some stuff is able to be rehabilitated. Some stuff we're going to have the manufacturer duplicate, but we're actually going to duplicate it exactly as it was. In particular, the pie forming machine is going to be identical. We have frozen pies ready to make the new pies exactly.
So when are we going to get to eat those little fried pies again?
Well, I would tell you what the schedule is. I would tell you when we have to present stamped plans. I would tell you when we can get to a purchase agreement with NOCA. We can drive the first piling, build it, fill it, make a pie. However, anybody who's listening who's ever remodeled one powder room bathroom knows about time and money, and it's going to be a little bit different. I would think reasonably and realistically that we should have pies within a year.
Okay.
Ask me that question again once the first piling has been driven into the ground, and I'll have a better estimate.
Well, thank you so much for doing this interview, and I am so thrilled to know that it's going to all be okay.
Well, I do think it's all going to be okay. And the support that we have gotten from every corner of this city really makes it easier for me to say that. From the state government, the city government, the administration, the city and state both have economic development teams, our council people at large, the city planning commission. I wouldn't even want to start to tell thank you to everybody because I know that I would forget some of them. But we have gotten a tremendous amount of support, and everybody is genuinely interested in seeing this project succeed. And that makes life a little easier.
Well, thank you so much, Drew.
Sure.
Drew Ramsey of Hubig's Pies.
Oh, honey pie, you are driving me frantic. Sail across the Atlantic to be where you belong. Honey pie, come back to me. Yeah. I like the light. Ooh,
Public radio contributor and freelance journalist Ian McNulty is also the author of Louisiana Rambles. As our rambling reporter, he's always taken us on another food journey. So, Ian, where are we rambling today?
Well, Poppy, we're going down to a really fascinating bayou community. And I think you know I'm a big fan of the back roads, me.
Yes.
One that here in Louisiana had eluded me for some time was Highway 70. This is a route that'll take you across the Mississippi River on the Sunshine Bridge, right there in the River Parishes. That's where it starts. And then down in sort of a southwest diagonal towards Morgan City. Before you get to Morgan City, you're crossing Bayou Lafourche, of course. And by that time, the term highway seems pretty grandiose for the road you're on. It's really just a two-lane road.
Yeah.
And to the unknowing motorist, you know, fixated on roads and looking at your map, even on your phone or whatever, the area doesn't look very promising. It doesn't look like there's much to see along the way, or much less anywhere to stop at. But one of my favorite back road finds here in Pierre Part is a place called Landry's. This is a pretty nondescript place on the outside, real easy to drive right past it. It looks like it could be a convenience store or maybe a laundromat or something. I mean, really doesn't look like a culinary destination. Don't let that throw you off. Of course, the seasoned traveler knows that's often a good sign for back road restaurants anyway. inside, you'll find a very fun, casual place. It's this huge collection of beer cans and beer bottles lining one wall, like from all over the world. Like customers bring them in. It's like this library shelf of suds, you know?
Uh-huh.
And the other attraction is this plastic rolling self-serve salad bar in the corner, too.
Of course.
So, yeah, between those two, you can kind of get a feel for the place. And don't let the name Landry's throw you off either. This Landry's is definitely not related to the corporate restaurant chain of the same name that you've seen around.
That's a very important distinction to make.
It is, yes. There's lots of restaurants around Louisiana called Landry's, actually. And this is just another one.
There's a lot of Landry's in Louisiana.
A lot of Landry's, a lot of families, a lot of family-run restaurants. They don't have to go too much further than the family name to get the name of the restaurant. But this Landry first opened their restaurant in 1972. Mm-hmm. So it's got some history to it, and turns out it was originally a fried chicken joint, though that's not on the menu anymore. But that's fine, because this modern Pierre Part Landry's that we're talking about is all about seafood. Of course, you have your usual fried seafood options, the platters and all that, plus frog legs and alligator. Shrimp and crab au gratin are big specialties, crawfish au gratin too. Sort of like a crawfish bread.
Yes.
Without the bread. So just sort of that gooey, crawfish, spicy, cheesy insides
Sounds
of it.
Simple.
There. Yeah. My favorite way to eat here, in fact, is one of their huge combo platters. You've seen this style at other Cajun country restaurants. It's not your typical seafood platter. So the crawfish dinner, for instance, gets you crawfish stew, crawfish bisque with stuffed crawfish heads, fried crawfish tails, crawfish boulets, which are like little, you know, fried croquettes of crawfish, even a potato stuffed with crawfish and cheese, all of this on a divider plate with, on the side, a cup of gumbo, just because you didn't have enough food on the plate.
Sounds like more than enough dinner for one.
Yes, it is. And, you know, these are modest portions of each one. And the crawfish, too, I was told, were part of the wild harvest from Bell River, just a few miles down the road. So
well known for the cleanest, best-tasting crawfish in the state.
That's right. Crawfish aficionados know Bell River. It's a basin crawfish, really good
Sandy
stuff.
Bottom. It's all about that.
Another good thing about this place, I mean, this is common for those Cajun country restaurants, a whole section of the menu devoted to gumbos and stews. It's not like, here's our gumbo. It's here's our entire range of gumbo. So gumbo with shrimp, gumbo with shrimp and okra, on and on and on, with different stews, including a turtle sauce piquant that's worth trying if they happen to have it. And you know what I love about this place, just to wrap up? The kids menu. Right there next to the grilled cheese, it lists seafood gumbo. Just shows you, Poppy, they're raising them right down in Pierre Part.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Thank you so much, Ian. Please come back soon.
Certainly will.
Louisiana Eats rambling reporter, Ian McNulty. After the next short break, Chef Jared Zarang explains how his upbringing on Louisiana's German coast influenced his cooking style. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Bashery native Jared Zarang did not set out in life to become a professional chef and restaurateur. But now, Jared is one of New Orleans' hot young chefs who specializes in showcasing our native ingredients and traditional tastes to their greatest advantage. Jared, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy.
So, tell me about growing up in Vacherie.
Well, it was pretty country. about as country as you can get. I went to school in Thibodaux, but being in Vacherie kept us far away enough that we could have a rural life. My family was a sugarcane farming family. We raised animals. And
so you grew up really sort of on a farm.
Yes.
And the land that you grew up on has been in your family for generations. When did they first settle there?
I think in the late 1700s.
Wow.
They had that land, and they also had land a little upriver in St. James Parish. The land where our farm is was owned by Bishop Schecksnyder, which is my grandmother's cousin. He brought Catholicism to the Lafayette region.
Really?
And he's
actually
buried.
Well, he did a pretty good job with that.
Right. He's buried in the floor of the cathedral there.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you grew up in Vacherie, and then you moved away from Vacherie. And tell me what you originally set out to do in life.
Well, I went to school in Baton Rouge for architectural drafting. I've always loved the architecture around Vacherie, South Louisiana architecture. And I thought that I was going to be able to preserve some of those buildings, but I think I was about 20 years too late because most of those buildings have been demolished.
So you were working?
I was working at a firm in Metairie. I did that for 7 years.
As a draftsman?
As a draftsman.
Oh.
Then Katrina hit. That kind of changed my line of work.
And it changed so many of our life direction. It's amazing what a big page turner that was.
It kind of gave us all the wake up call. You know, if you want to do something, then you should just do it.
Yeah.
And
so what did you want to do?
So we had always had dinner parties. One night after drinking probably a little too much wine, we decided that we were going to put a proposal together to take over a space in the French Quarter at Dumaine and Dauphine.
To open up a restaurant.
To open up a restaurant. We called it Eat New Orleans. We called it that to celebrate the home cooking of New Orleans and the home cooking of South Louisiana.
Well, that's delicious. And you had no professional training.
I had never worked in a restaurant in any capacity.
And so where'd you get your cooking skills?
Well, when I moved away from home, I wanted the same food that I grew up eating, that my mom and my grandmothers cooked. The only way I could get that is if I either went home and spent time with them or if I learned how to cook it myself. So I'd call them and either they'd write down the recipes for me or they'd explain to me how to do it over the phone. I kind of did that dish by dish and learned how to replicate their dishes.
So here we are after Katrina and you find some like-minded folks, and you decide to open up a restaurant. Tell me about that.
Right. David Smith, my business partner, grew up in the restaurant business. So he decided that if I wanted to do this, if I was serious about it, that he'd show me how to run a restaurant. And he guided me through the first days of Eat and actually, you know, opening Eat. And I had the architectural background, so I renovated it. And he finally had to tell me, okay, it's now time to stop renovating and start cooking.
And when did the restaurant open?
It opened on the Friday of Jazz Fest, the first Jazz Fest after Katrina.
Oh, have you ever heard of Trial by Fire?
That was it.
Wow. What was it like?
Luckily, most Cajun food is cooked very slowly. We worked out the menu so that we prepared half of the menu beforehand.
Because it was pot food.
Because it was pot food. It was gumbo and it was red beans and it was, you know, etouffee and all that. And I got that out of the way ahead of time. And then when it was time to open, it was just the dishes that we had to cook to order. That helped us out somewhat. But it was still, I still block out parts of it,
parts of that first week. You know, it's like childbirth. It's all the same thing. Well, you brought a special treat to show me into the studio today. So what's in that box?
The box is my grandmother's recipes, which, you know, I'm sure most grandmothers, their recipes aren't very organized. But
this is just a collection. And a lot of them aren't even
written down. Right, exactly. And these are just things that most of the things that I grew up eating that she cooked were not things that are in that box.
Oh.
So I guess she just, you know, did those off the cuff every time.
Oh.
So we found this box of recipes, and some are from her, and some are from her brother, who was an amazing cook as well. And my mom brought it up that, you know, maybe I should have the box since she didn't cook anymore. She always says now, you know, she forgot how to cook. You know, she doesn't taste like she used to. my mother and my aunts and uncles make sure that she's fed. And
so what are some of the treasures you found in the box?
I found a crawfish bisque recipe. Yes, which is something that we cook every year, but we've always guessed at how she made it. And I found a recipe on three very small pieces of paper, and it's her recipe for the crawfish bisque.
So how close were you when you looked at what she'd written down?
Well, I think we were pretty close, and we'd always cooked by smell and taste and if the consistency was right and everything. When she's tasted it in the past, she's always approved. But I'm glad to have her actual copy. There's no restaurant that can replicate Grandma's cooking at any point.
Well, I just have to tell you that your devotion to preserving and protecting our historic food ways that, you know, there's nothing in the world just about that matters more to me. And it's very inspiring to me. And I am so grateful that I finally wrangled you into the studio to come and talk with us. So thanks for coming.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
Chef Jared Zarang of Eat New Orleans and Vacherie Restaurants. City Farmers Market with one of my favorite vendors, Captain Mueller. Captain Mueller sells very dense, beautiful, authentic breads. So welcome to Louisiana Eats, Captain Mueller.
Okay, thanks a lot.
What inspired you to start baking bread?
Actually, when I was working here in New Orleans, I had a ship and a captain I knew personally, his wife was on board. She gave me a loaf of bread and the recipe to do some rye bread. And the first rye bread was solid brick. So all over the years, I refined it, and I found as a hobby after retirement that it is baking. And I found and did that about 15 years ago I started. And then about 10 years or 11 years ago, I bought a little farm up in Poplarville and built out a bakery. And got my the public health license and started to bake. And the flour comes from New York, from an American subsidiary of a German flour company in Germany. So they helped me to set it up and how to do it. And even to this day, I can call them and that I need some help.
Captain Mueller, what inspired you to start baking this bread?
I wanted to have decent bread and not the harmonica bread, as I call it. So I decided to find some German bread which is solid. And you take the Vollkornbrot or the dark rye and the rye bread, which is a solid bread, and it's nourishing. And I grew up with it. So I finally found it, and I'm selling it with a lot of success.
Now, I understand that your first customers before you came to market actually were your fellow seamen coming into port.
That's correct. I had a ship in Gulfport, and the captain was a good friend of mine, and there were a few Germans. The rest was Kiribati, and they liked the white bread, and the Germans said, I told them, I'll make the German bread for you. So I baked for about 2 years only for them out of the kitchen oven, and they sent me an email and said, we need 30 loaves. And next time they came in town, in port, I gave him the 30 loaves until they came back.
Would you take me on a little tour of the kinds of breads that you bake?
Okay, the first one is I do it in English this time. It's a multi-seed, the dark rye, which is a basic rye bread, rye flour with some seeds in like millet, barley, etc. It's very dense and it's very nourishing. The number two is following the trend in this country, whole grain. So I decided, with the help from my people in New York, to use whole grain, but put some seeds in there, like the same on that, it's pumpkin seed, rye, barley, and it's a lighter version. It tastes quite well, and I sell it as a lighter version to the dark rye. The advantage of all these loaves is that you can freeze the loaves. As long as you put it in the freezer bag, you freeze it, it will not lose its taste. You take it out, a couple of hours later, you can slice it. And
there's no preservatives in any of them.
There's no added sugar, no added fat, no preservatives. So they have to go, especially in the summer, have to go right away into the refrigerator. And I found out it's what I call it, it's a notch below organic. And people like it, and I sell quite a lot, and it's about 80%, good 80-85% on the Tuesday market is repeat business. People know it, and they complain if I'm not there.
Well, I complain when I don't see you, because you're always fun to visit with, too.
Thank you. But the only thing is, because I don't like to work anymore, I did that all my life, I only make the market on the second and the fourth Tuesday here on the uptown, and the Saturday before, and that's very difficult for people to comprehend, I do the downtown market. So that's what it is, 4 days a month, that's all. Otherwise, it's work, and I don't work anymore.
Well, a lot of people would say that bread making involves a little work. How many hours do you spend baking to get ready for market?
I do it in two portions. I do the dark rye and the rye. I do the day before, 2 days before, because that has to settle. Well, that's about 6 hours work with resting and proofing and so. And the other one, the wheat flours, is from 7 o'clock in the morning till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's lots of fun, during the summer.
So, Captain Mueller, you told me that you were responsible in the 60s for bringing the Beatles to the United States.
Yeah,
now, what Beatles are you talking about?
I thought the Beatle Volkswagen.
Well, that's quite an interesting job you had.
Yeah, but, we brought on the ship, I had about 2,000, 3,000 Beatles, the Volkswagen, the Fastback, the Carmangia, and the van. And we took back grain, phosphate rock, and coal back to Europe. Cleaned over there and come back. I did that for about 4 years. It was fun. And I learned, actually, all the four coasts. It's the West Coast, South Gulf Coast, East Coast, and the Great Lakes. And that's when I started to learn and love this country.
Well, we love having you here with us at the Crescent City Farmers Market. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks a lot, and I enjoy talking to you, and I hope everybody will love it.
Captain Mueller, bread baker extraordinaire at the Crescent City Farmers Market. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickey Brennan and Company, Lightsegan and Westside Lightsegan Funeral Homes, LCI Workers' Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.